This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
And what we learned is that there are wide variations in the range of environments the seawater greenhouse can be effective. We've seen these pilots in Oman and Tenerife and Abu Dhabi, so we've got a very good fix on the way in which these can operate in a variety of different environments.
Farm Zero is a five-year-old startup company that's a concept for sustainable agricultural systems that use seawater rather than freshwater as the core for growing fruits and vegetables. This concept could someday be a lifesaver in places dealing with water scarcity and other resource poverty. This week on Sea Change Radio, we talk to the founder of Farm Zero, Mike Fawcett, as he tells us about the company's technology and efforts in places like Oman and Grenada. Then we hear from writer Lauren Markham about the new generation of American hipster farmers, or farmsters. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Mike Fawcett. Mike is the president and founder of Farm Zero, and he's coming to us right outside of Rotterdam, Netherlands. Mike, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
Where are you as a startup right now? Why don't you kind of give us a snapshot of the company if you can?
The objective of Farms Zero, all of them, really is to develop farms that are in resource-poor countries or resource-poor states, if we're in the U.S., that are able to operate commercially while having the minimum environmental footprint that they possibly can. And basically, from an environmental perspective, that means zero water footprint, zero carbon footprint, zero chemical footprint, zero energy footprint, and zero genetic footprint. So our objective really is just to be using sunlight, seawater, and wind to generate as much produce as we can within the farms that we're running.
And you're not a nonprofit, correct?
No, we're a commercial business, but depending on the country in which we're operating, we are willing to establish nonprofit ventures that are able to operate for commercial purposes in the countries in which we're developing them.
So explain how the revenue model could work for both Farm Zero and local farmers.
Well, so the objective in these nonprofit ventures really would be to allow Farm Zero to go in, use the existing technologies that we otherwise would be using on a commercial level and a larger commercial venture, bring those into a particular area where there are resource challenges. For example, the Horn of Africa. There's a project going on right now in Somaliland that is using seawater greenhouse technology. And the objective in those places really would be to go into those communities and to scale down to the extent that you would be able to have a small commercial venture that could be run by a local community or a local tribe, that once we are able to establish the farm, get it up and running, then hand it off to the local community to let them continue it with just some consulting from experts at Farm Zero from a distance.
And explain how Farm Zero plans to approach the water issue connected with agriculture. It's just pretty interesting, not only from a climate change perspective, but also from a technology standpoint.
Right. Water is a huge issue in a lot of different places, and agriculture is a huge user of water. It's over 70% of all fresh water worldwide is consumed by agriculture, and in some places like the Middle East and North Africa, it can be up to 85%. A big challenge in a lot of these environments as well is that you're talking about very, very hot, arid places. And so the transpiration rates, basically the levels at which these plants sweat, are so high that it makes it virtually impossible for plants to grow in some of these regions without assistance, and certainly without controlled climate agriculture. It would be nearly impossible to grow in some of these places. I think what we're doing in with respect to water and with respect to these places that it would otherwise be impossible to grow is that we're, first of all, generating water where there is none. We're taking seawater and we are using a process that allows us to generate enough fresh water, not only to water the plants that we are growing inside our controlled climate facilities, but also to provide water for plants that are growing outside in the lee of these buildings. So water is a huge challenge in many, many places around the world. And agriculture is a user and an abuser of water in ways that should be better controlled and in ways that can be better controlled.
I wanted to actually ask you about the technology. You call it the seawater greenhouse technology. What is that exactly?
Seawater greenhouse technology was invented by a guy named Charlie Patton, who's from England. And basically, he started with the original idea that the same pad and fan systems that are used in greenhouses in hot, arid parts of the world, all around the world, can be used for the purpose of growing using seawater over those pads. The big challenge has always been, well, can you actually use the seawater on these pads without destroying the pads? And for many, many, many years, he has had to work to try and develop a system that would allow that to happen without the pads turning to mulch. And he has, in effect, cracked that cosmic egg so that he's to the point that the evaporative effect that happens on these pads allows the greenhouses to be cooled to the extent that plants can grow very well in the growing environment, and that allows enough water to be generated to feed the plants as well.
And I'm looking at a picture of the seawater greenhouse project, a pilot project in Oman. Explain a little bit more how that worked.
The Oman project, like several of the other seawater greenhouses projects, was set up really to get an idea. It was a feasibility study. It was set up to get an idea about how hot can we go with one of these greenhouses before it becomes untenable, before the technology breaks down and is impossible to use. How much wind do we need to have moving through the system in order for it to be able to function appropriately? Do we need fans to generate an appropriate level of wind to bring the moisture through the system? How cold does the water have to be coming from the ocean in order to provide the level of cooling necessary? And all of these things were done, and the mathematical modeling needed to be able to take in the variables that that were occurring on a daily level at in Oman were all subject to the study. And what we learned is that there are wide variations in the range of environments the seawater greenhouse can be effective, all the way up to 45 degrees Celsius and down to 15 degrees Celsius, depending on the wind speeds and the amount of sunshine that the greenhouse is getting over the course of the day. We've seen these pilots in Oman and Tenerife and Abu Dhabi and Gran Canaria, so we've got a very good fix on the way in which these can operate in a variety of different environments.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the founder and president of Farm Zero, Mike Fawcett. So, Mike, looking at the business model of Farm Zero, reading more about the seawater greenhouse technology, you have an interesting plan for the salt residue. Why don't you explain it a little bit more if you can?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I think it's one of the really interesting aspects of what we're doing with seawater greenhouse technology. If you look at where the soil has gone over the past 100 or so years, that a lot of the soil is going into the ocean, and a lot of the nutrients from the soil are going into the ocean from a variety of effluent. And these are becoming available when you are taking the seawater out of the ocean and putting it back into the seawater greenhouse system. So when we are using the seawater and over the pad and fan system, the leftover, basically, of the seawater is turned into something called virgin brine, which is a very, very good starting point for making salt. So we've also got people within our team who are expert salt makers, gourmet salt makers, and they have the capacity to help us take the virgin brine and turn it into very, very high quality gourmet sea salt. Additionally, there is the opportunity to take some of the nutrients that remain and put them back into the system so that they can provide additional nutrients for the plants growing within the greenhouse itself.
And explain how you would engage local communities and what some of the problems facing local farmers are, for example, in Grenada.
Well, I think that there are a lot of challenges in Grenada as an example. The primary challenges that they're facing are mostly environmental, that they've got occurring with fair amount of regularity, both drought and flood. And these have been increasing over the past, I'd say, 20 years. We're in an interesting position in Farm Zero in terms from a research perspective, because we seek out countries and communities that meet a certain set of criteria. And we're looking for countries that have water scarcity. We're looking for areas that have challenges in terms of their environment. And so we really are looking not only at what's been happening to them recently, but how has the water scarcity issue and the weather climactic changes impacted them over a longer period? Can we get a sense that things are even worsening for these communities? And when we have a feeling like a lot of these challenges are increasing in these environments, then that's a place that we're going to go. And we know from what we've seen in a place like Grenada that the severity of the storms are increasing, the number of the storms are increasing, the number of droughts that they're facing are increasing. In addition to that, they've got erosion challenges on the island. They've got saltwater intrusion challenges because they've overextended on the use of water in their aquifers. So they're dealing with a tremendous amount of challenges that, a small island is not typically going to be able to solve in a very quick amount of time.
Now, Mike, you've spelled out some of the problems that are facing some of these developing countries in terms of agricultural needs and water consumption. Farm Zero is just one company. In a best-case scenario, how do you hope that your model gets replicated and scaled up? Is there a chance that governments and other larger non-governmental organizations can engage agricultural communities in a similar way that Farm Zero is trying to do?
That's my hope. My expectation is that there will be other organizations that will see what we're doing, adopt the technologies and the principles, and take them forward. I think one of the things that we're trying to do in many of the countries that we're going into is to develop public-private partnership projects with the local governments, which is why we start by engaging the local governments first. The objective really is to set up educational programs together with the government to ensure that there are opportunities for people in the country and in the region to be able to become educated in controlled climate agriculture, and not only because it would benefit these local communities, but because it would help us to have people locally trained to be able to operate our farms wherever we go.
The company is Farm Zero. People can find it at farm-zero.com. Mike Fawcett. Mike, thanks so much for joining me on Sea Change Radio.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Alex.
They were hiding behind hay bale. They were planting in the full moon. They had given all they had for something new. But the light of day was on them. They could see the thrashers coming. And the water shone like diamonds in the dew. And I was just getting up, hit the road before it's light, trying to catch an hour on the sun. When I saw those thrashers rolling by, looking more than two lanes wide, I was feeling like my day had just begun.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by author Lauren Markham. Lauren, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much.
So you have a piece in Orion Magazine called The New Farmers. Why don't you talk first about what this movement is?
Yeah, so this, I was interested in writing this piece because I'm 31 and I have an increasing number of friends around my same age and a little bit younger who are going into the farming profession. And these folks tend to be more privileged farmers than we have seen in generations past, and tend to be younger farmers who are taking over, they're not people who are taking over their family farms. They're farmers by choice who often don't have heritage in farming, or at least not recent heritage. Many of us have farming, you know, generations back. And so this article is really exploring, like, what is this movement? What does it look like? Why are people choosing this this vocation, this profession? Especially, you know, folks who have really educated backgrounds and who have many opportunities. I was really excited to see so many people choosing farming over other professions, as opposed to choosing farming because that's what their family has always done.
Is it just the type of people that are getting into farming right now are from educated backgrounds and not inheriting their family farms? Or is there a real demographic shift? Are we seeing real numbers of people who are adopting working on the land as a vocation?
Yeah, it's still a vast minority, but the numbers really are shifting. So in the most recent agricultural census, which was in 2012, that census showed that between 2007 and 2012, the number of young beginning farmers increased almost 12%. So it's on the rise.
And for people who are not subscribers to Modern Farmer magazine,
yeah.
What does that depict and what can we glean from it?
From the magazine itself?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's this really interesting magazine, and I've actually written for it. Full disclosure, I've written for their website. Modern Farmer is almost like a lifestyle magazine that's focusing on farming and agriculture, and so it's this sort of like very it's a lifestyle magazine. It's portraying farming as very sexy and chic. Farming has this appeal. I write about this in the piece. It's sort of nostalgic and hip at the same time, and you know, I imagine. That could feel for people who've been farming for a very long time and who have been struggling in farming for a very long time. I wonder if that sort of aesthetic might seem either ridiculous or insulting. But certainly what it is doing is it's calling more attention. I mean, we see this nationwide with in the food movement, that the food movement is helping calling more attention to agriculture, and we're paying more attention to where our food comes from and the people who grow our food. And we're paying more attention as a country to sourcing our food and to the fact that people are actually growing and picking our food, and that it doesn't just sort of magically appear on our plates or on our grocery store shelves.
So these are
these are generally farmers in their 20s and 30s who are going into it and haven't really had the quote-unquote real-life financial issues that a lot of the hard scrabble farmers that we tend to associate with from multi-generational farms that go back to the Dust Bowl. Will these next generation of farmers be able to succeed with the current policy the way it is, or are they going to have to be the leaders to forge a new structure or landscape that will enable farmers to live well off the fruits of the labor? You give an example of one of these people who calculated that they're only making $5 an hour. That's pretty hard work to be making sub-minimum wage salary.
It's an incredibly hard scrabble life. I mean, not on Dust Bowl proportions, but it's incredibly challenging and incredibly difficult. Even for folks who start with some capital, who start with land, and you know, folks who are 25, and don't have children can, lead a certain kind of life with certain kind of financial limitations. Once you start to have kids, that might start shifting. So it's incredibly difficult. I talked to many folks, and I talked to some of the leaders of the Greenhorns. Severin von Scharner Fleming is the director of the Greenhorns organization, which is, it's basically a movement that it's kind of a resource sharing and networking organization that connects new beginning farmers who are often young farmers with one another, helping to, you know, advocate, lobby, share best practices, and helping kind of help these new beginning farmers feel like they're not alone. And I think that the movement and the growing numbers is where the hope and possibility is. That sort of was my takeaway, that in en masse, you can advocate for better policies. You can advocate for better food policies, for better agricultural policies. You can advocate for access. You can network and share resources, share farm equipment, share land. So I think that the hope in the kind of shift comes in the growing numbers, for sure. Severin von Scharner Fleming also brought up a really interesting point to me about privilege, because I had asked that question about privilege. You know, like what does it mean that we're seeing folks of privilege going into this when farm into farm ownership and farm operation, when for decades and centuries, really, the farm workers and the farm laborers, the people who are picking the food, are often incredibly underprivileged people in California. I think it's about 65% of the farm labor is undocumented immigrants. So those kind of complicated dynamics of privilege of this new emerging class of farmers. And she said, well, you know, the fact is that actually can be a positive thing. The fact that people of privilege who are frankly used to getting their way, who the system, they were born into systems that are inherently skewed toward favoring folks of privilege, that those folks can actually start shifting the system for everybody, and that actually could be a really positive and hopeful thing.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to author Lauren Markham. So I want to turn to what a lot of older people will associate the younger generation with, and that's technology.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the farms that I profiled, Sweet Root Farms, which is in the Penn Valley of California, I spent about an hour and a half out there in the fields interviewing Dina Miller, who's one half of the farm operating duo. And she had, you know, I talk about this in the piece, she had her kind of tool belt, and she had all of these farm tools and all of this stuff hanging off her belt, and she had her cap and she had her, you know, gloves, and she was out there weeding when I came to meet her. She also had a very well protected iPhone in there that was binging, you know, throughout our interview. And at the end she said, oh, look, I've gotten 5 orders just in the past hour. So she's out there in the fields weeding carrots while she's also taking orders for, you know, someone had contacted her about arranging flowers for a wedding, and someone else had contacted about a CSA. So it's this really fascinating thing of this kind of direct access. And it takes out, there's the opportunity of really taking out the middleman, which of course then increases profit and increases that, you know, again, what a lot of these farmers are after is going back to a sense of connection to our foods, that if you know your farmers, you understand your food more. And I think that that's, you know, it's not just about the capital. the technology. It's not, the technology isn't just positive because of the access to capital, that's incredibly important, but it's also about that connection, that direct connection between the buyers and the farmers.
And generation aside, let's just talk about small versus big farming. How can big agriculture set this movement back? And has it put any kind of policies, or has it been lobbying for any specific policies to take this movement out at the knees, if you will?
So I'm not totally sure that this movement is a big enough threat to big agriculture yet. The numbers are still incredibly small. Even though the growth is astounding, the overall numbers are incredibly small. I mean, just talking about organic, this was a shocking statistic to me, and I live in the Bay Area, so you know, I'm like kind of in a bubble here, but organic represented only 4% of the total national sales in 2012. That's not big or large, that's just organic. Most of the small farms tend to be organic. Most of these, you know, everyone that I talked to and profiled have organic practices, but it's only 4% of the national total. And a lot of organic sellers are these big industrial agricultural companies. So I just don't think that the numbers are big enough yet that the big agricultural companies are going to, you know, try to take these younger farmers out at the knees. I think, though, that the system and structure, like we were talking about earlier, is just so skewed to economies of scale, also so skewed to just the status quo of these bigger operations.
I'd be curious to know that 4%, what it was a decade ago. I remember hearing statistics not so long ago that sounded much less significant. 4% is starting to make a dent in the type of foods we eat.
Oh, absolutely. That's that number. Thank you for saying that. It's up 183% from 2007. So it's absolutely growing. It's just the overall numbers are still so small. And, you know, that number is not disaggregated for small versus large farms.
Right. And when you think about the way we eat food, as opposed to going to your grocery store and eating and picking out your vegetables, as opposed to the vegetables that are going into canned soup and getting sent all over the world, it starts, if you start comparing apples to apples and the way they're distributed, it's not insignificant. It's probably much, much higher than 4%, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And just to kind of give an example of, you know, the economy of scale, and kind of just an example of something that I learned of how the sort of system is skewed toward the economy of scale. So I spoke with Matthew Shapiro, who is the owner and operator of Buckeye Ranch, which is a lamb operation in Grass Valley, California. Sorry, in Penn Valley, California. And he has such a small operation, and he is not allowed to slaughter his own animals. So he feeds his animals, raises his animals, but he is not allowed to directly sell meat.
So why is that?
So in order to sell his meat, he has to have it, you know, in order to be above board, which of course he wants to do, he has to have his animals slaughtered at a USDA approved facility. And so he has to pay and transport his animals to be slaughtered by somebody else at quite a high cost. That's of course cheaper at scale, and then transport them back and sell them directly at the farmer's market himself. So he is not able to, you know, he as much as he got into farming in order to kind of see the entire life cycle of the animal through, there's this critical part, right, the death of these animals that he's been caring for that he is not allowed to participate in. And in fact, he has to pay somebody else to do.
The piece in Orion Magazine is called The New Farmers, author Lauren Markham. Thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate you having me on.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Anuman and Neil Young. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.